Welcome to the Book a Week podcast, jointly hosted by the SEPT University Library and the Center for Research on Architecture and Urbanism.
Thank you, Eric, Marie, and Solly for agreeing to do this podcast for the Book a Week program. And this particular podcast will be about the edited volume called The Subaltern Urbanization in India. It's edited by Eric Dennis and Marie-Helen Zera. I wanted to start off with, let's say, the general premise of the book itself, that it's one of the things that, of course, the book sets out to do, or this volume sets out to do, is to shift the focus of urbanization from, let's say, typically a metrocentric approach to look at census towns and small towns in India. Could you tell us about why this focus, the shift in focus, is necessary or was necessary when you decided to put together this volume?
Yes, the change of lens and focus was an attempt to look at what is in fact constitute one third or eventually an half of the urban setting in India, meaning that it is a very distributed urban situation in India. We are always thinking of megacities and the problem of megacities, but in fact, half of the urban citizens in India live in small and medium cities. And it is important to raise this question and understand why there is this diffuse urbanization and growing space for small cities and census town and so on, and how in situ urbanization, meaning that it's a place which change to urban by change of activities, not migration, that are the main driver of urbanization in India today. And it is important, and it's a structural condition.
Yeah, maybe I can add that actually it was almost like a conjunction of different interests. So for instance, some of us, in particular Eric and others at the Center for Policy Research as well, had started to really look very carefully at census data and the patterns of urbanization, and started to see from a quantitative point of view the rise of census towns and smaller towns and agglomerations which were, I would say, outside the big metropolitan cities. And on the other side, some people, including me, who were most probably much more focused on qualitative work and who had done a lot of work on large metropolitan cities for various reasons. First, sometimes personal reasons, just to want to change and to look outside what you've been doing for a long time. And also because we started to really understand that a lot of the processes were happening outside the metropolitan city. We're also interested in social change and in other urban settlements. And I think what we tried to do in this project, and therefore the book and the various publications, was to bring together, I would say, a holistic approach looking both at quantitative and qualitative changes. And I think that's what was really the attempt of the group that we represent today, because I think there were many of us, among 20, I think, contributors to this volume.
Yeah, thank you. First of all, thank you also for putting this together. I think for me, what was sort of personally exciting, because I had worked in South Canara in 1998 to about 2004 or 2005 on environmental planning kind of projects in both Udupi and Mangalore. Udupi was then a small town. Later on, it was made into a corporation. But at that point, there was a kind of a hint of something, because we were doing kind of environmental planning in terms of looking at solid waste, looking at drainage systems. There was a huge environmental project planned out by the ADB. There was a lot of public protests on that. But one of the hints that came out over there was that the way we thought about this part of Karnataka somehow seemed to be wanting to have a frame of Bangalore. Okay, so you had to figure out how could Mangalore become a kind of version of Bangalore with the IT, and somehow then places other than Mangalore, you know, would become some kind of, you know, tourism kind of a places with beaches thrown in, sort of aspiring almost to be Pondicherry. So there was that, and that seemed to be a big issue, not just Pondicherry, in fact, Goa. And there was a lot of local resistance to those kind of ideas on both counts. So I think when this project came up, this really, it was kind of a return to a territory I was familiar with, but with completely different lenses, as Eric and Marian, you know, have pointed out. And to me, there were kind of three aspects to this, which then underpinned my own focus on this region just beyond Kerala, Kasaragod, in fact, going up to Kundapura. So, and that region was specifically came out of a sense that these had particular histories of settlements, which we were now calling urban, which was different from south of Kasaragod into Kerala, and different from north, from Kundapura going up to Karwar. So what is it that was kind of special? And I think that laid the kind of ground that we had to think of when we're thinking of these kind of small towns. We cannot, and it's not very useful to have the frames which are normally placed around metropolitan cities and ideas about which are coming from new economic geography, which are centered around a particular kind of ideas about agglomeration economies, which according to me theoretically was not just problematic in a kind of academic sense, but in terms of how that would then have policy derivatives. So I think one of the things was that to look at these cities beyond usual master planning kind of norms. I personally found that land issues would be exciting to look at, because maybe there was a connection with how we talked about the histories of land settlement, and what it embodied beyond just a simplistic real estate kind of a logic. If you take the real estate logic, then it will fall back into the new economic geography ideas. The second thing was that how territories and built form kind of operated beyond this rural-urban binary. And I think that's a big contribution of this volume, to get people to think about it, to look beyond those boundaries. And third is in terms of, again, as a critique of the new economic geography, to look at economic logics which were quite transnational. And now, of course, it's evolved into a whole set of literatures coming from history, a little bit from anthropology about oceanic trade, the Indian Ocean, etc. But at that time, that wasn't there. But it was quite evident that like the place that I was looking at, even outside Udupi, which was forming around the fishing industry, which we had first done work in 1999-2000, because we were doing that was one of the sites of kind of environmental planning with the Udupi Municipal Corporation at that time, council. It was a council then. Was that was globally connected to Korea, Japan, Madagascar, through cashew, the cashew trade, through fish pulp, fishing nets, which the guy whom I interviewed he said, oh, if I had like 200 more workers, I would capture the complete Latin American market for fishing nets. So you kind of, suddenly find that these might look small towns, but actually once you start talking to people, it completely breaks the, you know, conventional cartographic logics that you're assuming. Another example of breaking these kind of logics was actually in ideas about sacredness and what were complex meanings of land. So I sort of got drawn into this whole Bhutakola and Spirit Possession, which of course now, and at least in Karnataka, it's made famous by a famous movie called Kantana, which I think is a poor representation of the real, at least whatever I saw, the quote unquote the real. So I think these are the three kind of pointers to why this book kind of opened up then, but I would say even now, after, because when did the book come out? In 2016, something like that. We are talking of, we ended the project, I think about 6-7 years back. And I feel that now, after looking at some of the land conferences that have been happening in Delhi, this book is even more important. So I would say it's kind of touched on a kind of a issue which really needs, you know, much more work. Because the danger in this book is to, it will kind of show it as a kind of a ethnography of, you know, cute small towns, but then somehow it will go back into a logic of a metro kind of thinking. Yeah, those are my points I think to highlight. Yeah.
Thanks for that. Sorry, so many things open up from there. Maybe to start from your last comment about the cuteness of small towns, no? Like, I mean, the kind of assumption that small towns are frozen in time, this sort of, you know, do not participate in, let's say, economic activities at the national level. But also there's an interesting idea in the shift of focus from metropolis to, let's say, metropolitan conditions to, let's say, small town urbanization is also the question of urgency, no? Like a lot of urban studies that were done in the 90s had a certain fervor of urgency to them. Like in the sense, you know, like the slum problem in Bombay is an urgent question. It's an immediate question. The problem of what to do with millions in Bombay is an urgent question. I think one of the interesting things about this book is that while in the meanwhile, when there's a lot of seeming urgencies around in big centers, there are also urbanization processes that are, you know, so to speak, spread out across the national landscape, so to speak, no? Because this book is focused on India. Did you guys have that sense that you know, that some, it might come across as if this the study is not addressing, let's say, an urgent question, or is it an attempt to make a seemingly urgent question more apparent in that sense? So
I think, again, there were two ways to look at this problem. And we first started to, I think, have a more academic perception to the problem. Our objective was to analyze what was happening in these spaces which were not visible, which were, as you say, understood as ordinary, with the idea that, okay, any small town looks like another small town somehow, while, you know, metropolitan cities have an image, have a culture, have a certain identity, which small towns maybe do not have. So I think we really started with a very strong analytical angle. I think we didn't have at all the idea of that small towns being, you know, frozen in time. And we were very aware that these were places where politics, social changes, economic dynamics were very strong. Then I guess as we went along, we started to realize the importance of putting this on the table and on public debate, because as you said, there are a lot of issues. There are a lot of, for instance, we talk about employment in our introductions, which was not necessarily the core of our a project at the beginning, but we really saw the question of employments, trades, as very critical to understand the economic basis of these small towns. Similarly, issues of social changes were very critical. And it appears to us that these were sites where a lot of what was happening in contemporary India were taking place. So I think the urgency is more the result of the interactions we had with the spaces and the people we encountered in these spaces. And we wanted to put this in public debates. For instance, Soli mentioned the question of master plan, and, you know, and we tried, which I'm not sure we tried successfully, to say that we should not have a blanket position on what is public policy for small towns. There are specificities. We were very focused on understanding the genealogy, the historical pathways of these towns to be able to understand what was happening and what were the challenges for each of these sites.
Yeah. I'm not sure to have to add on this question of urgency and the case of small town as opposed to urgency, but in a way, we've tried to rise that one of the answers to urgency is also to look outside of the Zoom we have on apparent very important problem in metropolitan area. And if you change the focus, you see that there is other question who matter. And it's also a way of say of make the more urgent question less important in a way, that urgency is maybe it's somewhere else, because you have also to support this development of small town, which needs services like sewage or water or electricity to run activities and so on.
Just to add to, in fact, what you, put your finger, thumbs, your entire hand on in terms of the idea of urgency, I think one of the big politics of what we saw, again, I'm going back to slightly before the project. In 2003 or so, with this huge funding by the ADB, is that you had a kind of a anxiety of the growth of in Bangalore, in Hyderabad, each of them wanting to have IT corridors. And this is the rise of the IT from 1998 onwards, with new kind of governance systems, like the Bangalore Agenda Task Force in Bangalore, being imposed or being dumped onto small towns. And at that time itself, I discovered the hard way, because we were working with the municipalities. They would tell us quite directly, without any diplomatic language, that we were kind of at times, even with our kind of environmental planning approach, was sometimes coming from a Bangalore or even worse, Delhi type of imposition. Whereas they had their own ways of thinking about what was urgent, what was not urgent. And I think that was a kind of a important point, because they were often accused of being sort of slow town, slow thinking, small town, slow kind of thinking. Whereas actually they had their own logics of being able to discern on the politics of something being made urgent, something that is the urban crisis. Like you say, slums in Bombay, midlands in Bombay. Okay, you can think of similar crises in Delhi. Okay, and definitely similar crises in Bangalore, which then turn out to be justifications for huge investments, which, for example, like the ones that's happening in Chennai itself, not far from where I'm sitting, then getting locked into budgets, which would knock off 30% of the budget of both Mangalore and Udupi at that time, to pay back loans for items that they don't require. And those items are being pushed because it's supposedly urgent and in a crisis, whereas they have other urgent things to do. So I think that this issue about anxiety of the metro as a crisis place being then dumped onto large gram panchayat villages who at one point refused to be urban, like Virajpet, because that constrains their political power and economic decision making, as well as in Mangalore, Udupi. So I think those are kind of interesting points that for me were coming out, in this project. So I think this idea about urgency is really spot on. If we have to do another follow-up write-up on this book project, I think it would be useful to pick up on this theme. What does it mean to be urgent from a subaltern perspective, which might also tell you the politics of urgency imposed in large metro areas. Because that's the other thing. What's really the binary between small town and metros? I mean, is there such a binary?
So again, building on Solly's last comment, in the foreword, Amitabh Kundu mentions that, you know, that the book also interestingly challenges the typical notion of a trickle-down effect of urbanization, that it's assumed that, you know, metropolises, metropolitan centers are the, you know, the place where all the action happens, and then the distribution takes place to smaller towns. So that there's an interesting line where he says that, you know, the district level urbanization, in fact, has a negative effect on the growth of census towns. One would assume the other way around, right? Because if we look at the district levels urbanization census statistics, it should convey or kind of on the outset say that there's been a rise in, let's say, number of towns in general. But there's an interesting suggestion that it affects the growth of census towns negatively. And that seems to be also the kind of link that he makes with economic opportunities and the way that happens. So do you want to say something about that? So before we move on to the next question.
Briefly, what I can say that we, in different perspective, quantitative as well, qualitative, we demonstrate that the, and it was one of the aim of the book also from the beginning, that people in small town have certain agency to make their trajectory, to make venture in economics or to have education and so on. And it's not only because they are at the proximity of a bigger town. It's also because locally there is capabilities, there is history, there is capital, and there is also the possibility opened by globalization and more open economics to make connection abroad without passing by the big cities. So you can have a development of a cluster in knitwear industry or whatever without the passing by a bigger cities and directly from China to Tamil Nadu small town without passing by Chennai, for instance. And you have also in certain places the role of certain diaspora, such as in Indonesia or such as in Malaysia, of certain group with small towns that are developing business in connection or with Middle East in coastal area, for instance, in Kerala or Tamil Nadu. So yes, you have this kind of dynamic which are not depending of a larger city. In other instance, of course, you have also the influence of big cities in redistribution of activities, because one of the driver is, of course, that these small cities, because they have less regulation, sometimes they are not in the frame of cities, but still villages, they have less regulation regarding pollution, regarding access to land and so on, or even union of workers. So plants, industry are very keen to localize in this small town. And also it is a reason that many of these small towns are not willing, or the people driving these cities are not willing to enter the frame of town, because then come more tax, more regulation, and so on. So there is also a politic of being or not being a town.
On that note, what I had this question about the politics of enumerating something as a census town, right? So, I mean, I know only the case of Tamil Nadu, also by anecdote, I've not studied it, that the sudden rise in the urbanization levels of Tamil Nadu is also the enumeration of a lot of, you know, what were once villages as census towns. And that is also linked with, let's say, how the political landscape of the state is at the moment. And does that have an impact on, let's say, the functioning, the governance of so-called these emerging urban areas or small towns?
I think, yes, we were very attentive to what we had called the politics of classification. We mentioned it in the introduction, but I think it's also in our EPW paper and most probably even more developed in our paper in the International Journal of Urban and Regional Research. And you've pointed out, and it's very interesting, that to understand this, one needs to look at the state and very often to go down at a lower scale than the national scale. Because at the national scale, very clearly, we've identified a number of factors that play out in terms of the governance of the town wanting or refusing to be urban, as Soli was mentioning in the case of one place in Tamil Nadu, because if you become urban, you start to pay more taxes, you have to pay for urban services, you have more regulation in terms of what you can do with the land use and what you can do in terms of environmental regulations. And this plays out differently according to the social composition. And we did some other work with other colleagues comparing Bihar and Haryana, in Bihar, and it was very clear that in Bihar, or even in Odisha, this is really related to who are the groups. Some groups want to remain rural because they clearly want to benefit from rural schemes. There's also the NAREGA, of course, that could play a role. While, for instance, in Haryana, what you want is to make the land market strong, and you are not very concerned with NAREGA. So to look at politics of classification enables to really see the various regional trajectories. At the same time, it's very clear that the manner in which public policies are organized in India, by having strong distinction between rural programs and urban program, play out as a major factor of this classification. Or a lot of our work also shows that sometimes the boundaries between what is urban and what is rural is very blurred. And in, for instance, you can take even just aspirations of people. They could be very similar, whether you are in a large village or in a small town or even in a big metropolitan area. But the politics and the manner in which the public policies are designed keep on producing that binary of rural and urban, which is strangely imprinted in some kind of cognitive, if you want, framework of thinking about India, while we actually show that this is not the reality on the ground. So
I think also in terms of the this idea about enumerating the urban, there are two interesting things. Like just last week when we started teaching, in both my classes, with about 60, 64, students, you can say 58 to 60 of the students in a class of 64, 65 are coming from non-metro cities. Okay. And here I'm teaching a course on urban cities, where the bulk of my source material is all about metro anxieties and urgencies, as you talked about. So there's a kind of a, both a kind of a conceptual but also a pedagogical crisis in how we teach about the urban, how we teach about cities, and where, how do you do field work, And why is the fieldwork part much more important to theorize from, rather than basing our ideas about some kind of a meta theory across ideological viewpoints, whether it's planetary urbanization or the equivalent of new economic geography. All of those ideas are essentially, in a way, emphasizing a kind of a metro logic. One of the interesting works of Ananya Roy, 2015 work, which is, I think the title is called "What is Urban About Critical Urban Theory?" She goes to a place, Bhatpara, Dhakuni, which coincidentally, actually, I worked in early 2000s, when I was on a kind of a economic development project funded by DFID, and where she shows quite effectively is how local administrations play the category of urban to basically get various kind of funds, but they want to be still rural, because as Eric and Marilyn, emphasize, is that you kind of get dumped with a whole lot of additional taxes, and also the costs of playing politics goes up because centralized parties demand more funds, which at a panchayat level, you actually have a greater distribution of elected representatives as compared to when you get into a small town or even worse in a metro setting. And I think that's where this idea about, sort of the politics of enumeration of what is urban becomes important because, it's kind of central in terms of how we think about the urban, or rather more accurately, who's thinking of the urban when those kind of schemes are being planned out and then they get appropriated.
Thanks, Ali. So actually, that brings to my last question, and we can maybe take this one round of discussion and close it for this session particularly. And that question is related to the various methodologies that one sees employed in the book, you know?
Yeah, there are many, many different methodology in the book. I think I want to go back to the genealogy of our project in some sense, because we decided very clearly that we wanted to provide different angles to understand this small town. So we really try to show through a myriad ways the really both the phenomena of these small towns at the scale of the country, which is a major factor. And that can be seen through the chapters that look at employment, that look at economic data, that look at land use changes, because we also used Landsat data for the project. And at the same time, wanted to show that even though that phenomena can be read at the nation scale for India, can also be read very differently when we look at very specific spaces. So even in the qualitative chapters, I think there are very different methods. Some of them are more based on questionnaires. I think this is the case of the chapter of Eric on the diaspora in Porto Novo. This is also the case of my work on political elites in Haryana. Some of them were chosen different spaces in a region. This is the case of Gopa Samanta in West Bengal. And what I would like to say, because I think this was the last question, so I'm going to say something that you didn't ask, but I want to mention about the project, is when we started to present our work and to discuss it, two things are very clear. First, I think it showed, as Soli said, that by looking at Indian urbanization, we do contribute, I think, to larger understanding of urbanization worldwide. That's one contribution. The second one is, I think, we also realize that there are a lot of people now starting to work on the same questions, first in India, and Soli mentioned Ananya Roy's book, but there's also Sai Balakrishnan. Historians are also starting to look at this urban-rural binary by looking differently at archives. So there's a lot of work around these questions in India, but there is also a lot of work on African cities, on Southeast Asian cities. So I think it's part of a larger movement. We didn't realize it at that time. I think if there's something that we can draw from this work, I think these are some important takeaways.
Yeah, on the methodological dimension, I think one of the strong point of this joint work was to have this multi-scale approach from a global scale on the place using statistic, but not only statistic, but also a reflection on policy, urban policy in India and so on, and articulate with a very local, very research and also multidisciplinary dimension in that. From anthropology to demography and geography, urban planning and so on. And if we look at our career, it's not happening every day that we are able to gather such kind of team. It takes time, it needs means, and maybe it's something we can do one or two times in our life, academic life, to gather so much people and be able to complete a research. Mm-hmm. We do a lot of attempts like that, but often we are not able to reach this achievement of having a coherent book, which is pointing to something important topics.
Maria, I completely agree that, in fact, one of the reasons the book also fascinated me was that it's and also my colleagues when I was teaching at SEA, the School of Environment and Architecture, we did, Solly knows this, we visited Chennai when he was in IIT. We did a lot of studies on second cities in South Indian states. And in fact, this book has been a companion for that thing. And I think it's very influential that way. So yes, thank you for bringing that that point out on how the book has contributed to shifting the lens of studying urbanization in general.
I was just thinking that where would this book take us in the future, in a sense? And I would see three kind of things. One is as Marilyn just mentioned, the work of Philip's work on the boring industry through these trucks, which then go to Africa. I mean, in a sense, if you just for a moment, or if even not a moment, if you just think of that, can you think of the urban being constituted through various families and clans, okay, in the way they settled a space, okay? And you write that book not as a quote-unquote social science text, I'm using it derogatory, but rather as a set of film scripts, novels, set of stories, which put together urban, which is coming out of those kind of clans and families, you know, interlinking, some of them moving in, moving out. I think you'll get a far more set of, sort of complex insights about causative factors, you know. And so I think that's number one, is that how do we think about not sort of human dimension, but not in a cliched way, but in the kind of way in which Philip Travistan has kind of, done that work. Secondly, is that if you look at some of the interesting, at least whatever I have come out and whatever I've been looking at in recent times, historical accounts, for some reason, a lot of these are set in northern Bombay, in Malad, in Thane. You take the work, I think, spurred by Miriam Dosal's 2011, but also 2005 work on land histories in Bombay. Her 2012 book, Theaters of Conflict. You look at the work of Nikhil Rao, Sangameshwaran, Tharta, all three of them look at or reveal through kind of an interesting and important way of looking at historical archives beyond a kind of meta logic which came out of the early work. In fact, they critique Ranajit Guha and some of the subaltern studies works, which kind of assume that land was settled. So you're now having a work after 2015, 2017, 16, 17, which starts to, in a sense, come back to these kind of family clan kind of textures, which open up very different logics to how normally you would have seen the city to be settled, which I feel the kind of planetary logic or link to that, whether it's, frontier capitalism or speculative globalism, all of these ones which are premised on these kind of larger meta moves, even in attempts to provincialize them, like the work that is happening in Jakarta, kind of miss the point, because ultimately their categories of analysis come back to slums and informal sector. There's no possibility of an imagination beyond that, And there is enough work, coming out of basically Singapore, Hong Kong, Southeast Asia, which shows that some of these categories came out of the Cold War anxiety, where rather than seeing complex forms of tenancies and rents, put everything down to slums, because that is where, communism was supposed to have bred as an extension from Vietnam. So if you look at some of the work which is coming out on as a critique of these, shows the politics of this categorization, which then we see, as we see in Ananya Roy's work, sort of being questioned. Third is that why should we only look at the quote unquote South? I mean, my exciting time, and maybe Eric is sick of this, but I've found Obuwele so exciting because it's sort of that formative frame was actually rooted in the suburban work in South Canberra. I think if I had not done the suburban work in South Canberra, I don't think I would have sort of visualized Obuwele, which is a suburb, quote unquote suburb, because I think that question itself is a huge crisis, conceptual crisis. Why should we treat a place just outside Paris as being dependent on sort of the core city of Paris, right? We get into that binary again. But I think that those kind of interesting questions about how we think, places beyond just, quote unquote, the global South, which is again, make it into a container. So I think this work, if you think of it as to where it goes in the future, from 2017 when this book came out, and if one had to think about it in 2023, which is what, 6-7 years later, I think these would be some of the really interesting essential points about looking beyond, and kind of further reinforcing this analysis in terms of how it completely, kind of upsets the conventional way of thinking about cities and the urban.
Well, thank you, Sully, and thank you, Mari and Eric. I think this is the time that we have. I think we can go on and on, but this is quite concise, and I think it just fits in the time frame.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. Do not miss to like, share, and subscribe to our podcast, available on all your favorite podcast apps.